This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, a popular Netflix documentary comes under fire for dismissing Pacific Islander history.
I mean, we have oral histories of our ancestors building this city. So to say that it was built by aliens, for us it's funny.
And the French baguette has been awarded special cultural protection status by UNESCO. But in France's contested Pacific territories, love for the loaf is divided.
I mean, for other Kanak people, we cannot say that it's our heritage because it's a part of the French colonial object.
All that and more today on the show. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. So glad to have your company this Wednesday morning. First, though, Fiji's election supervisor has accused a major political party of misinformation after it claimed the Attorney General visited an election printing centre and ordered that CCTV cameras be turned off. The extraordinary dispute comes just a week ahead of Fiji's national election. For more, we're joined by reporter Lide Mvono in Fiji. Good morning to you, Lide.
Yandra, Priyanka.
Yes, Yandra. And Lide, what is behind this face-off? Can you give us more information about this? It's between the election supervisor and the National Federation Party, I believe.
That's right, Priyanka. And the National Federation Party has, over the last few weeks, at least up to a month, had a very successful campaign all over the country, having put out some pretty strong candidates, are now having a larger presence than they've had in about 20 years. And so what they are alleging is they received from various sources information that the Fiji First Party's General Secretary and, of course, current Attorney General Ayasen Kayum had visited a local printery where ballots were being printed and that he wouldn't leave despite being asked to by company security and the police, responding only when the supervisor of elections was brought. Now, what the NFP tell me is that they thought the information was credible and took it to the Fiji Elections Office, hoping an investigation would ensue.
And what did ensue?
Well, what a very, very strong response from Mohamed Sanim, the supervisor of elections, saying that nothing of the sort which had been described in the National Federation Party's letter took place. He says he was never at the premises, that he wasn't called in to, have the Attorney General removed, as were the claims of the National Federation Party. So quite a big standoff now, just, in the last few days leading up to the campaign blackout period.
And do we know if those comments were made after an investigation took place into the allegations posed by the NFP?
That is exactly the disappointment of the National Federation Party, who, of course, I spoke with this morning. They said they expected an investigation. That is the protocol and the process. But so far, we've heard strong defense from the supervisor of elections, but no indication that an investigation will take place, Priyanka.
Mm. And so what would come of this? We've seen these statements from both sides, and we expect that, I guess, to perhaps continue these this war of words, I guess. Do we know if any concrete charges or anything will come of these allegations?
At the moment, we don't. There are no indications that an investigation will take place. But the supervisor of election is alleging purposeful vendetta on the part of the National Federation Party. So I am expecting to hear more from the supervisor of elections this afternoon as to possible action against the National Federation Party. He seems very upset that the letter was published. As I understand it, it is protocol and process to raise your concerns of irregularity to the supervisor of elections. But there is a sore point around the fact that the National Federation Party released their letter of complaint to the media.
Mm. Let's step back for a second, Lide, because the context here is that it is just a week before what's turning out to be a very tense election time. And we have heard for a number of weeks, for a number of months now, opposition members saying that, these supposedly independent bodies are being used for political purposes. Is there talk of that as a result of this latest spout as well?
Absolutely. I mean, what the other parties are saying, not just the National Federation Party, but, you know, the other parties hoping to replace the Fiji First government, is that it's irregular to have a complete defense of complaints of irregularity. What they hope to hear, what they should be hearing, is investigations that, you know, due process will be followed so that the claims and the concerns of the people will be taken seriously. And as you know, from the previous elections and even leading up to this one, there's a lot of mistrust in the community. There's a lot of allegations already surfacing as to the validity and the dignity of our electoral process. So for the supervisor of elections to immediately come out in defense of what appears to be the Fiji First Party, or at least in defense of the electoral process not being interfered with, doesn't augur well for people's trust of these independent bodies. At the very least, they should have received some indication that claims will be taken care of, not just this one, but any other claims that people come up with.
Mm. In that case, do you think it might influence what voters think too as they head to the polls?
Well, look, Priyanka, the atmosphere in Fiji at the moment is quite hot, not just in terms of the weather, but the war of words that go on now between the nine political parties. Well, a lot of the parties are together and there's a lot of ill fighting. There's a lot of toxic conversations happening. There's a lot of yelling. The rallies now have that kind of characteristic. And now, as you know, of the last 48 hours or so, there's a lot of also what looks to be witch hunts, seemingly independent bodies coming down hard on candidates who seem to now have a strong foothold in this race to be the next Fijian government. So this is not going to be very helpful leading up to 7 days from now when we all go to the polls.
Mm. And speaking of, I guess, the tension and things heating up, there's been another case there in Fiji. All this is happening as two senior members from another major opposition political party, I believe, not NFP, have been charged with vote buying. Can you tell us more about this case?
Linda Tambuya and Dan Lobindan are both deputy party leaders of the People's Alliance Party, which currently seem to be, neck to neck in this race with the Fiji First Party. Now, the People's Alliance Party, of course, is led by former Prime Minister and former coup leader Sitiveni Rambuka. There are three deputy party leaders. So these two are two of the three, and they're being charged with two counts each of the prohibition of vote buying and a breach of campaign rules. Basically, it's alleged that these two gave $1,000 each in prize money, one for a volleyball tournament and one for another community competition event under the Rock the Vote campaign. Now, the Rock the Vote campaign was a campaign pretty early in the year, encouraging people to come out and vote, encouraging people, to join in the democratic process, which has been an issue here in Fiji. The Fiji Elections Office has been working very hard as well to improve voter turnout. And so what's alleged is that the two of them, by giving prize money in these sporting competitions and in food distributions, that they unduly influenced people to vote for them or to vote for their party. So that's basically what's happening right now. And the charges are being brought by Fiji's Independent Commission Against Corruption on the request of the Supervisor of Elections in the Fijian Elections Office. So it's not very helpful in terms of the way people see the democratic process taking place over the next 7 days. There's a lot of outcry. There's a lot of allegations of witch hunt. And there's a lot of allegations that, people who are seemingly in the lead in this race are being taken out one by one.
Mm. I mean, does this mean these two candidates can't stand for the election as these charges, I assume, go through the courts?
No, our electoral process allows for people who are charged to contest elections. Once they're convicted, however, they are unable to contest the elections. And so as it stands, they can still, people can still vote for them next week. They are not due back in court for well after the elections have taken place and a new government is sitting. So at the moment, they are still in the race for a seat in the next Fijian parliament.
Mm. So we are just 7 days away and things, you know, as we keep on saying, are heating up. With a week to go, how are things panning up? We have pre-polling progressing. Do you have any thoughts about what the key issues might be as more people head to the polls next week?
We are now into our fourth day of pre-polling. That's almost 80,000 people, about 10,000 to 15,000 every day in some of the most remote locations around Fiji have been given the opportunity to vote at home, basically. So these are places that are not big enough to have their own polling stations. So we have elections officials going to village churches and village halls and village schools, and in some cases, you know, in a tent in the middle of the village green, giving people the opportunity to vote right there. So these are very important exercises because in the last elections, only 64% of people who were registered from these remote areas were actually able to cast their votes. So the elections officials are hoping to improve that number. So that's running pretty well. So far, uneventful, except for weather, of course. We are in the middle of our cyclone season, so we're dealing with some severe weather in some of the islands. But that seems to be going well. In terms of the campaign period, we go into a blackout at 7 a.m. on Monday next week. So these are the last few days of these races. These are critical times for these political parties that are vying for a place. And in the case of the three major parties who are clearly now in the front line, which is, of course, the Fiji First Party, the People's Alliance Party, and the National Federation Party, their teams are all over the country right now, some of them in remote locations. And the social media campaigning that's happening is unprecedented, Priyanka. We're also seeing, as I mentioned earlier, lots of toxicity right now, which we've come to expect when we're in a Fiji election year. But I think this year it's unprecedented. There's a lot of money in the campaign offices. So there's a lot of social media campaigns. There are signs everywhere. We are now fully aware of who the frontliners are because there are mega billboards all across this country, you know, telling people who to vote for. But as we're seeing, we are expecting, you know, a lot more excitement in the next few days as we see investigations and complaints being handled quite differently. And we're going to be seeing more people in our courts, I suspect, Priyanka.
Very interesting. Yes, very exciting times. I think we keep on saying that things are heating up there in Fiji. Lede, it continues just to heat up to new temperatures as far as politics goes. But thank you for bringing us the latest there, Lede.
Thank you very much, Priyanka. Have a good one.
Yes, that was Lede Mavono. Yes, bringing us all the latest thrills and spills when it comes to Fiji's politics. Who knows what next week will bring. Lede, of course, was joining us from Suva. She is ABC's reporter in Fiji. You're listening to Pacific Beat. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. Hope you're having a lovely Wednesday morning. Pacific archaeologists have criticized a Netflix TV show for attempting to rewrite Pacific history. The show, called Ancient Apocalypse, has been pulling large audience numbers worldwide in the popular streaming service, but archaeology experts are calling it pseudoscience and say it is a disservice to Pacific history. Hugo Hodge with more.
Did you know that you were picking a fight with academia?
Experts on Pacific history have slammed a hugely popular new series on Netflix, which they say is founded on racist ideologies. The program, Ancient Apocalypse, hosted by Graham Hancock, claims to overthrow the paradigm of history.
We have forgotten something incredibly important in our own past. And I think that that incredibly important forgotten thing is a lost advanced civilization of the Ice Age.
Professor Patrick Nunn from the University of the Sunshine Coast, who specialises in Pacific geography and archaeology, says the program is misleading.
You know, most of the content and most of what is proposed in this is without any kind of scientific foundation.
In the first episode, Hancock offers up a revised version of Indo-Pacific history. Using two lesser-known archaeological sites as examples, Gunung Padang in Java, Indonesia, and Nan Madol in Ponape, Micronesia, Hancock theorises that an advanced civilization built both sites over 20,000 years ago during the last ice age. That's tens of thousands of years earlier than archaeologists believe these sites were built.
It's my job to offer an alternative point of view. Perhaps there's been a forgotten episode in human history.
Professor Mark McCoy, an expert on Pacific Island archaeology from the Southern Methodist University in Dallas, says Ancient Apocalypse uses classic moves from the pseudoscience playbook.
The production value is high, right, and presenting itself as sort of a factual series. Another one is, of course, to demonize the expert.
Perhaps the extremely defensive, arrogant, and patronizing attitude of mainstream academia is stopping us from...
The experts are always against me, and archaeologists are certainly the bad guys in this series.
Hancock suggests the volcanic rock used in both Gunung Padang and Nan Madol is proof of megalithic architecture from a lost civilization.
One that specialised in building with blocks of columnar basalt. It's a style of construction I've seen before in this part of the world, on the tiny Pacific island of Pohnpei.
But Professor McCoy points out that columnar basalt is found at volcanic hotspots around the world.
So they are just a thing that happens when you have volcanoes. They don't happen every time, and so they're not common, but they're not exceptional as a sort of geological framework. And so what you just happen to have is two groups of people who are building using the same sort of natural bit of stone.
Hancock then says his discovery of ruins below seawater suggests it was built earlier than we thought.
Archaeologists believe most of the construction visible at Nan Madol today dates to around 900 years ago, when the blocks were quarried at a neighbouring island. But during my explorations on previous visits, I found several of its megalithic pillars extending out below the waterline, suggesting that earlier versions may have been constructed when sea levels were lower. Could Gunung Padang's architects have made it across the South Pacific to Micronesia?
Nan Madol is known as the Venice of the Pacific because it's made up of 93 artificial islands with megalithic structures on them. Professor McCoy says he would be surprised if there wasn't remains of the site underwater.
The entire island is made of volcanic rock, and that's where these pillars, this columnar basalt, it's where they naturally occur. If they weren't also under the water, I would be extraordinarily surprised.
The version of Micronesian history put forward in Ancient Apocalypse is the furthest from the truth. According to Augustine Kohler, the acting director of the Micronesian Office of National Archives and Cultural and Historic Preservation.
I mean, we have oral histories of our ancestors building this city. So to say that it was built by aliens, for us it's funny. It's not something that we take seriously.
Present-day Ponapeans can trace their ancestry back to the builders of Nan Madol.
You know, when you're born, you belong to a certain clan, and you can trace your clan back, and your clan has a function in society, and some of the clans were responsible for building this site. So all over Ponape, I mean, we can trace it back. Even today, our traditional system, where you have the Nan Marquis, the High Chief, I mean, this is all derived from Nan Madol.
Professor Nunn says Hancock's interpretation of Nan Madol is complete nonsense.
There's absolutely no evidence to suggest that it wasn't constructed by the ancestors of the present Ponapeans, the present people who live on these islands. Hancock and his ilk, which I would refer to as pseudo-scientists rather than proper scientists, they've made all sorts of outrageous claims about Nan Madol that really are really incredibly insulting to the ancestors of the Ponapeans that did create these structures.
Theories about an advanced civilization lost to rising sea levels are not new. Critics of these theories say they strip Indigenous peoples of their rich histories and can be traced back to white supremacist ideologies. The concept of an ancient super race was popular with the Nazis.
This kind of interpretation of who made Nanbadol is founded very strongly in the racist philosophies, if you like, of the 19th century. You know, it's simply not possible, you know, for people who were not Europeans to have built such incredible structures. Therefore, it must have been transplanted Europeans that somehow built them.
Professor McCoy says Ancient Apocalypse is creating fantasy with people's real heritage.
If the roles were reversed and Micronesians were making these sorts of stories up about Stonehenge or some European sites, that Europeans would probably find it offensive.
Professor Nunn believes these programs should be seen purely as entertainment.
As soon as you start to take it seriously, then you are really engaging with all sorts of nonsense and all sorts of demeaning, racist-informed agendas. And I think that's where it becomes really dangerous indeed.
That was Pacific archaeology expert Professor Patrick Nunn, ending that report from Hugo Hodge. And we have asked the person behind that docuseries, Graeme Hancock, to comment, but we have not yet received a response. And now it's time to find out what's making news around the region. And I'm joined, as always, by Carl Evans to do that. Good morning to you, Carl. Have you checked out Ancient Apocalypse, that story, that documentary from the previous story?
Honestly, Priyanka, I got 5 minutes in and thought it was an absolute snooze fest. And, haven't been back since.
Oh, and which, very interesting.
After listening to that really great package by Hugo, I'm glad I didn't.
Yes, yes, indeed. It seems like there's a bit of misinformation there, and particularly when it comes to Pacific history. I'd love a show about that dives deep into Pacific history, though, perhaps from a Pacific historian telling us. I feel like there's such a wealth of knowledge that doesn't necessarily always make it to mainstream media.
Particularly that city that was referenced within the package.
Nanbadol,
unbelievable.
Yeah. Yes.
The pictures of that are incredible.
Yes, yes. Amazing stuff. So Netflix, if you're listening, how about a Pacific history show told by actual Pacific historians? So what about that? But let's go to some other news around the region. First, Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has postponed his trip to Papua New Guinea. Oh dear, why is that?
Yeah, so Mr. Albanese, he was set to fly to the country on Monday for a 2-day trip. But poor Mr. Albanese, he actually announced that he tested positive to COVID just before he was set to leave. And it's the second time he's actually had the virus. He got it earlier on this year, just before the federal election.
That's right,
I believe.
Right. Yeah.
So anyway, he's postponed that trip. But in a bit of an interesting interview with The Guardian, PNG PM James Marape actually said PNG was ready to welcome him, COVID or not. So some pretty interesting comments, which he elaborated on. He said PNG were the least vaccinated nation in the Pacific. And he doesn't know about the world, but definitely in the Pacific. And if Mr. Albanese has tested positive, it's his decision to make whether he travels or not. But the country would welcome him regardless.
Well, that's very bizarre. I mean, you know, we are past, I guess, the height of the pandemic. Borders are opening up. But it just seems almost courtesy and polite. If someone has COVID, you say, take your rest. Don't push yourself. I'm sure Mr. Marape was trying to be, you know, inviting.
I think it was maybe one of those things where he thought he might have been sounding funny, but it kind of just came off a bit strange. But at the very least, we know he's flexible.
Yes, and particularly considering those low vaccination rates that Mr. Marape did mention in that interview as well. Perhaps would get you to think twice. Did he make any other comments to The Guardian?
Yes, there were some more serious things brought up within that same interview. He did actually address the geopolitics and the global superpowers jockeying for position, and he didn't mince his words either. He basically just said, keep your fights to yourselves, and just given PNG's station as a very much an emerging nation still, he can't afford to get involved in trade disputes with, you know, people like China and Australia and in the US.
Yes, pleading neutral, I guess, which seems to be the way for a lot of Pacific nations, understandably, as this geopolitical, I guess, yes, swells around them, this battle swells around them. But let's now head to Aotearoa, New Zealand. transgender athletes will now be able to participate in community sports in the gender that they identify with, and they won't need to justify their identity. What does that all mean, Kyle?
Yeah, that's right. So Sports New Zealand, so the country's overarching sort of sports governing body, they've unveiled its new transgender guidelines, and its guiding principle, it's pretty simple. It's that individuals should be able to take part as their self-determined gender and not as the sex they're assigned with at birth. However, it's still going to be up to the individual sports to define how those transgender athletes participate. So it still looks a little bit muddy from what I can see. And those guidelines, like I said, this is just going to be in relation to community sport and won't apply to elite sports. So this is only going to be sports that are organised through clubs, schools and events, and not your actual professional sports and things like that.
I guess a step forward for trans acceptance and rights. I know a lot of trans children can sometimes find it hard, particularly in schools, participating in school competitions and sports. So there could potentially be a step forward here, though it is still early days, it sounds like. But it is a controversial issue at times, this question of transgender athletes in sports and transgender children in sports. Has there been any opposing remarks, opposing views to this?
Yeah, there has. And not surprisingly, like you said, it's incredibly controversial and complex. Some groups and some athletes have come out and said it prioritises ideology over women and girls, and they'll obviously be the ones who lose out as a result. But supporters of transgender participation argue that not enough research has been done into whether transgender athletes actually have an advantage against women when it comes to sports. So, I mean, yeah, I guess depending on who you speak to, you'll probably get different points of view, and it's probably dependent on what sport you're playing as well.
Yes, indeed, and we'll see how that all, I guess, unfolds in Aotearoa, New Zealand. I guess they're taking that first step, and we'll see particularly, Pacific groups and people there and children who might be participating in some of these community sports, how they might feel and be impacted by this decision. And now to Cook Islands. They've announced a new airline partnership, or two new airline partnerships, in fact. What is this all about?
Yeah, so they'll be receiving direct flights from the US and Australia, but not until midway next year, so midway through 2023. So this is reported by the Cook Islands News, and it follows ongoing calls from the tourism sector to increase flights from major centres. They've had a real rough couple of years in the tourism game, like you know, most countries have. So this partnership will see direct flights from Hawaii to Rarotonga kick off in May, followed by direct flights to and from Sydney from June.
Interesting. I guess it's that balance that countries need to strike, particularly, I guess, the smaller, less ventured countries mm-hmm. like Cook Islands, about increasing the number of flights, particularly increasing the number of direct flights and making sure there are passengers to fill those flights as
yes.
well. Do we know how many they're hoping to, have directly from these major cities?
Yeah, so it's going to be two a week to start, but that could increase based on demand. And even two a week, actually, is probably more than I would have thought. So it's pretty good, I've got to say. And that comes amid a very, like I said, a very slow tourist season around the Pacific and just flight troubles in general around other parts of the Pacific. I actually read a couple of days ago, or yesterday, sorry, that passengers were stranded in Port Vila after more ongoing issues with Air Vanuatu. A flight was cancelled there and wasn't able to be rescheduled until the 10th. And fuel supplies are currently hampering flights in PNG, with major fuel supplier Puma Energy currently feuding with the PNG banks.
Oh, very interesting. Yes, as airlines, I guess, pick up after the pandemic. Interesting to see the developments there. Kyle, thank you so much for the stories.
Thank you, Priyanka.
That was Kyle Evans booking his flight to Cook Islands, I'm sure, speaking to us there about the latest news from around the region.
Celebrate the pride of the Pacific.
You know, we're proud of our country and our heritage.
Stay up to date with all the latest sporting news.
So emotional every time you go out there and you sing the national anthem.
And hear inspiring stories from some of the Pacific's finest athletes.
I've grown so much confidence within myself, and I never thought I would be the player that I am today.
Watch That Pacific Sports Show, Wednesday nights at 7 PNG time on ABC Australia.
You are listening to ABC Australia. Thank you so much for your company. You're listening to Pacific Beat. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. As global temperatures rise, the risk of Pacific crops like cacao and vanilla dying out is increasing. But farmers here in Australia have proposed a possible solution. They are turning to indoor vertical farming. There are hopes that indoor farming will help control spiraling food prices and protect producers from the recent huge financial losses from natural disasters. Those involved admit energy use is a major issue, but they argue it's one that can be overcome. Stephanie Smale reports.
When floods swept through Queensland's Lockyer Valley west of Brisbane earlier this year, some farms were out of action for months. But at Barden Farms, crops including basil and Asian greens growing in their huge raised greenhouse stayed high and dry. National manager Nathan Claxon says protective cropping has paid off.
On our field farm, we were out for months. Neighbours down the road further in the lower areas, they were out for a lot longer than us as well. So we found that in the hydroponics, especially this system here, straight back into it, is very good for us.
With farm workers in high demand, Nathan Claxon says it's easier to attract staff to work in the gentler environment of the greenhouse. And other farming pressures like pest management have been more straightforward too.
With a greenhouse, we have a lot less pest pressure come in the greenhouse, means less sprays. In winter, we think we didn't spray chemical for 5 months, so we had no sprays, and a lot of benefits for us. You can walk in, you can visually see, because it's so close, where your crops are. We can forecast better.
With the climate outlook so uncertain, vertical farming and protected cropping sound like they should be a no-brainer for Australian farmers. But there's two big hurdles in the way of them becoming the norm: power and money. Professor Paul Gautier from the University of Queensland's Alliance for Agriculture and Food Innovation says indoor farming does suck up a lot of power, but solar could be the answer.
Of course, the grid is going to be challenged by vertical farm, and so we need to think ahead and think, well, when the city is developing and when we are going to the future, we need to start including vertical farm as a way of growing, and so we need to include that into the infrastructure that we're going to build for the future. But I think it's a big advantage that Australia have with the ton of sunlight that we have, more than the rest of the world.
And he points out the huge financial outlay required to start indoor farming will pay off in the long run.
You could know what the yield is going to be in 2, 5, 3, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years from now, because it's inside the building, always the same environment. And so even so, it's a huge investment in terms of energy and infrastructure. It's also a safety and a risk, a lower risk than we could have.
He argues the potential is unlimited.
Things like cacao or coffee or eventually vanilla, something that is going to disappear across the world because of climate change, because it's going to be too hot or not the right conditions. And then we can suddenly grow them into productive cropping environment here in Queensland, which is one of the advantages. So there is a lot of variety. I think every places will have different requirements and we'll just have to adapt to it.
Australia is still catching up with the United States and Europe, but Stacked Farms Chief Commercial Officer Michael Spencer says local producers have learned from their mistakes, particularly with energy use.
We really look at closing that loop off and what we can do to help control that narrative and really drive benefits through the business beyond actually sourcing power. So can we get other benefits from the power generation, whether it is heat, whether it is carbon, that we can utilise?
Stacked Farms has a 4,000 square metre warehouse on the Gold Coast where crops like lettuce will be safe from the elements and grow under artificial light.
We're a fully controlled environment here, so we've got the opportunity to have a look at a wide range of products. So we're moving straight into testing in the fruits, so strawberries, blueberries, capsicums and the like. Also looking at a range of flowers, so for pharmaceuticals, nutraceuticals, the extracts market.
And he's expecting many others to follow suit.
Yeah, whether it is glasshouses or single-level operators, moving from a moderately controlled environment to a more fully controlled environment, I think you'll see more advances in that space as well.
That's Michael Spencer, the Chief Commercial Officer of the company Stacked Farms, ending that report by Stephanie Smale and David Chen. You're listening to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Priyanka Srinivasan. The French baguette has been awarded special cultural protection status by UNESCO. But despite the honour, the crusty bread continues to have a complicated relationship in the French Pacific. Some residents see it as a mealtime staple. Others see it as a symbol of French colonialism, as reporter Dubrovka Volodev found.
A baguette to share with friends or family. It's many people's idea of a laid-back breakfast, and one that's been made a cultural heritage. While it's quintessentially French, their ancestors brought it to the Pacific during colonial times. Rere Agbefe from Western Sydney is part Tahitian and says it's a staple for many people in her home country.
The baguette, the whole family enjoys. We break it off or we cut it off all together. We're actually all sharing, breaking bread, basically how I see it. We break bread on a daily basis with our loved ones. So it is a very much staple food. It's a delicious staple food, but they are very much aware that it is a French-inspired, like a lot of their menus are.
In Vanuatu's capital, Port Vila, the baguette is the one item at Le Parisien Bakery, according to Carol Nikahi.
Everybody buys baguette when they come in the morning. First thing they ask is for the baguette. So French people and some locals.
The baguette as we know it today was standardized about 100 years ago. It has to weigh 250 grams and be 80 centimeters long to be classified as the real deal. Made with only four ingredients, flour, water, salt and yeast, the dough must rest for at least 15 hours at a certain temperature, according to the French Bakers Confederation. Rere Agbefe says when done right, it's a delicious and mouth-watering food.
It's fresh. It's daily. It's fresh. When I come back to Australia after having my holidays visiting family, I actually will, for the first 2 weeks, keep eating French baguettes.
And in the French territory of New Caledonia, French settlers in the 19th century brought the recipes with them. They started selling baguettes, which can now be bought in bakeries and most supermarkets in urban areas. Local journalist Brigitte Wapp says despite calls for independence from France, the baguette is popular in the capital city, Nouméa.
Everyone buys it because it's we used to have it every day. It's common. We can eat bread like we eat yams or tapioca. It's now really common and it's, an habit. Everybody can eat bread in the morning breakfast or tea time and with meal also. When you go to the restaurant, you have free bread, free baguette.
But in the Pacific, does the baguette symbolize French colonialism in the region? Charles Weah is from New Caledonia's pro-independence FLNKS, which is the government party.
The Kanak people, we consider the baguette as something that has been imported from France. Conception meant food in New Caledonia because we took it as a symbol. I mean, for us, the Kanak people, we cannot say that it's our heritage because it's a part of the French colonial object that has been imported from France because we've been Francisized, because now in New Caledonia, when you try to see how we consume all the food that have been imported.
Associate Professor of French Studies at Australia's National University, Leslie Barnes, says it does raise some questions.
There are certainly pockets, especially in a place like New Caledonia, where obviously we've had quite a lot of debate about whether New Caledonia should remain part of France. There are certainly people there who are acutely aware of its colonial origins and may see consuming that staple as a gesture of complicity.
But Associate Professor Barnes also points out in many nations, the baguette has been adapted to local tastes and these varieties can now be found alongside the French traditional style.
Dubrovka Volodya with that report.
Pacific Beat.
Now, let's head to Papua New Guinea for a story about the famous Kokoda Trail. Trekkers and tourists are back, but a lack of upkeep has seen parts of the trail reclaimed by jungle during the pandemic. However, it's the state of the Kokoda Hospital that's got local NGOs most worried. For more, Pacific Beat reporter Kyle Evans joins me now. Good morning to you, Kyle. Now, we just celebrated the 80th anniversary, I believe, of the Kokoda campaign in Papua New Guinea. A lot of trekkers were back there, but it's the hospital that's getting this attention. What exactly is the issue there with that hospital?
Yeah, well, there seems to be a number, Priyanka. I guess the first one is that it's not actually clear who maintains the hospital. So the Rotary Club actually built the hospital to support local villagers in the area a number of years ago. But over the years, it's kind of slipped through the cracks a little bit. So while the government pays the wages of the employees that work there, there's sort of no real formal guidelines as to who actually owns or services it, despite the fact that it actually services around 40,000 people in the region. So it's largely fallen to NGOs like the Kokoda Memorial Foundation, the Kokoda Initiative, to help with the supplies and the maintenance and just upkeep of the building. But that's costly. And as you're about to hear from Eric Wynn, who is the director at the Kokoda Memorial Foundation, there's certain things like generator maintenance, for one, that they simply can't help with. And the hospital goes without power for hours on end.
Every time we go up, you know, we check it, try and maintain it, but they haven't got the ability or the technical know-how to maintain it. It's that simple. Somebody, they should have a maintenance program to just keep it running all the time, because it's the only power that the hospital has.
That was Eric Wynn, who seems to also be having power through that audio. He's the director at the Kokoda Memorial Foundation there. Now, we are talking about that hospital and the lack of funding, Kyle, that hospital has. What impact does that have on not just the trekkers, but the local community?
Yeah, so what you'll often find with trekking companies is that they'll provide their own equipment and care to trekkers who fall ill while undertaking the trail. So those who are sort of really sick, they'll get airlifted to Port Moresby and places like that for care. However, it's the locals who do occasionally struggle for treatment just due to the lack of upkeep. So the generator that powers the hospital, as you just heard from Eric, is very old and hasn't received maintenance. It actually only runs for 4 hours a day. So it's without electricity for the hours in between. As a result, there's just a lack of food supplies. It's often actually left up to the families to come and feed the patients that are receiving care in the hospital. So trekking companies will actually often donate supplies like bandages and things like that to help them get by in the meantime, and painkillers as well.
Oh, well, interesting. Well, I guess it's part of going to those communities is providing that. But you are talking about those donations that are helping to keep this hospital, I guess, afloat and care for its patients. What kind of things exactly are being sent over?
Well, one of the things I did actually find out as I did a little bit more digging is that they actually get a number of supplies sent over from overseas. So I spoke to a man named Clayton. He's the owner of Whitsunday Ocean Services. They're based out in Airlie Beach in North Queensland, and they provide safety and compliance supplies to commercial vessels out that way. So they actually work with the Kokoda Memorial Foundation to top up the hospital's medical supplies. So they send over thousands of dollars worth of equipment, things like scissors, tweezers, bandages, even food and water supplies, like stuff that's designed to help you survive on a deserted island, essentially. So they actually send that stuff over to them, and all simply because the maritime guidelines that they have to abide by in Australia means they've got to replace those things once every 2 years. So, I mean, technically they're sending over expired goods, but because it's equipment that doesn't tend to age, the hospital actually gets great use out of it.
Very interesting. So what does need to be done to fix this issue?
Yeah, look, there's a number of things. Obviously, external maintenance, things like Eric mentioned before. I just think there just needs to be a more streamlined process with who's running operations over there. There does seem to be a real disconnect. Obviously, it's probably not something NGOs can afford to do sustainably. However, it's the sheer remoteness of the hospital that just presents so many problems. You can really only fly in on a fixed wing or a chopper to get there quickly, or you've got to endure a pretty long trip by a truck on pretty poor roads. As a result, supplies often go missing while en route. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, a bit of a 360-degree solution to streamline that process is what's needed.
Yes, very interesting stuff about that very famous trek and track and trail, particularly for Australians, but also the health situation of the surrounding communities and the hospital there. Thank you, Kyle Evans, for bringing us that report.
Not a problem.
That was reporter Kyle Evans talking about the state of the Kokoda Hospital, obviously near that Kokoda Trail. That brings us about to the end of Pacific Beat. I am Priyanka Srinivasan. Thank you for joining us here on a Wednesday morning. And as a reminder of our latest and top stories today, Fiji's election supervisor has accused a major political party, that's the National Federation Party there in Fiji, of misinformation. That was after the party claimed that the Attorney General of Fiji visited an election printing centre and ordered that CCTV cameras be turned off. We spoke to reporter Lide Muvono about that. And we also had a look at a Netflix documentary getting some heat from Pacific historians about its attempts to rewrite, they say, Pacific history. If you want to catch up on either of the stories or any more of our stories, you can head online to our website. That's ABC Pacific. Just type that into your search engine and you'll get to us. Otherwise, you can also tune in this afternoon at 3 p.m. PNG time to hear an update on the stories on our afternoon version of Pacific Beat. Until then, have a lovely day.